I tell all the kids in the back room to get out here. We're going to get started. I'm going to give you 60 seconds. Dr. Sharp, didn't you know this was tuxedo only today? Dr. Nazer. Started? Mark? Okay. Well, it's my privilege to introduce the family medicine residents. These are about to graduate, assuming they do a good job today anyway. If they don't, then we have the privilege of keeping them for an extra year at no pay. So your opinion does count here as to whether or not they'll be successful in moving on. I have their personal biographical notes that they shared, and I'll share those, but I do want to say that every year it's a privilege to be involved with residents. And once again, these six residents have been a remarkable bunch. Really superb doctors. I would be happy to have them take care of me or any of my family, which has been true for many years, except for Vanna Irving, whom we will not allow to take care of our family. Actually, she's right there, and she's doing great. She's about to complete her fellowship in obstetrics. So first of all is Brett Martindale. Brett was raised in Caldwell, Idaho, went to BYU as an undergrad, graduated magna cum laude in 2009 with a bachelor in science in physiology and developmental biology. Following his undergraduate degree, he studied medicine at The Ohio State University College of Medicine. I said that right? Did I say that right? Okay. He has been a resident of McKay-D and will graduate, like I say, tentatively next month. And he will be doing a sports medicine fellowship down in Provo at Utah Valley Regional Medical Center. He and his wife have two children. He enjoys sports, camping, and hiking. He's a very enjoyable ping pong player, and it's especially fun if you beat him because he gets really grumpy. So I'm going to introduce all three of these speakers before we turn the time over, and it'll be in this order. Greg Burfine grew up in western Montana, stayed in his hometown Missoula for college at the University of Montana, and after finishing there, took off a few years to hone his school bus driving skills. And then 2 days before starting medical school at University of Colorado, he married his college sweetheart, Kelly. And then his goal has been all along to be a rural physician in a small Montana town, which he still hopes to do again, assuming he graduates. They came here because of the excellent training offered at McKay-D Hospital. This is his words, by the way, not mine. Partly, of course, due to the remarkable faculty. They've had their first child, Savannah, while here, and Savannah has been a delight and a privilege of mine to take care of as a primary care doctor. So after residency, he and his wife are headed to Red Lodge, Montana, where he will double the population. He will work at a 10-bed critical access hospital, and he and his wife are looking forward to living closer to family and exploring a new part of their home state. Bryce Osborne was born and raised in South Jordan, Utah. He did his undergraduate work in biology at Utah State and then attended the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Did I say where you went to medical school? Did you go to medical school?
No.
No? Okay. He just skipped medical school after school bus driving, but he did stay at a Holiday Inn. So Bryce finished Medical College of Wisconsin, and likewise will be graduating hopefully next month. They have a one-year-old boy, which has also been fun to watch grow up this last year, and a daughter on the way right before graduation. He enjoys basketball, golf, dirt biking, and a good book, and has been a very delightful softball companion on my team and plans on practicing in Harriman, Utah, where he will be doing outpatient family practice. Turn the time over to Brett. So each will speak. Following that, we'll have time for questions for this group of three. Then, starting at approximately 11 o'clock, we'll do the next three residents. You're on.
Thank you very much, Dr. Campbell, for that introduction that I wrote myself. As he said, I'll be graduating this year and I'll be continuing my training in sports medicine. But before I get started with my talk, which happens to be about sports medicine or a topic within that subject, I'd like to, on behalf of my five other colleagues, thank the Ogden Surgical Medical Society, while I pick this up, for the opportunity that they give the residents every year to share something that's been important and time-consuming and something that we've sacrificed, and the chance to present that to you. And even though we've been dreading this day for 3 years, we're excited to finally be able to do that here today. There we go. So I would like to talk today on a subject that's controversial, at least when it touches the aspect of endurance athletes within the sports medicine field. It's not as publicized or as well known as, say, the concussion issue, but it's something that still is very important to these athletes. And there's three things that I want to get across today. And one is impress upon you the understanding, or at least maybe the questions that face monitoring ferritin in elite endurance athletes. Secondly, I want to share with you a small study that I was able to do here with the Weber State cross country team in relation to ferritin and monitoring it over the course of a season in these athletes. And most importantly, I want to identify further areas for research to fill in the gaping knowledge gaps that we have concerning this. I have no financial relationships, but I do have a question for everyone. What do you think is most important to a runner? Because I don't really know, because I'm not a runner. I'm more of a couch potato. But I came up with a few things that I think seem to be pretty important to the runners that I know. One is feet. Feet seem to be pretty important to a runner. They can't run without them. They like shoes. They talk about stride length and heel striking and toe striking. Things that I don't worry about as I walk. I keep dropping that. There we go. The second thing, and the main reason why I'm not a runner, is the fashion. Because I don't want to wear short shorts while my legs move fast. Third is fitness, obviously very important to runners. The venue, is it competitive? Is it for pleasure? Is it uphill, downhill? What kind of terrain are they going to be running on? And of course, how fast they run. But I say that the most important thing that I've seen in runners, and all of you that'll be participating in the marathon tomorrow, the thing that you're going to wish you'd have paid attention to other than all that training, and the thing that these college athletes' moms call them on the weekends about to talk to them, how is this going, is obviously ferritin. This molecule that represents a very accurate measurement of our body's iron stores. That's what they all worry about. And I dare you, go up to a college athlete, an endurance athlete, they know what their ferritin is, because we're looking at it, and we're giving them iron to increase their ferritin. And this is done in every college that I know of, and in a lot of high school athletes too. Now, it makes sense that we would be checking a CBC and looking for anemia, because anemia does affect performance, and correcting anemia brings people back towards baseline performance. But taking that a step further with ferritin, what about if we optimize their iron stores? Well, that's a good idea, and everyone's doing it. And they're doing it orally, they're doing it parenterally, and even here at Weber State, if you have a ferritin less than 30 before the beginning of the season, you're given oral iron for the remainder of the season. And here's the data to support this practice. There is none. There really isn't any. And yet we do it. And I don't care where you go, they're getting supplemental iron to correct a low ferritin level. And, you know, it makes sense why they would be doing this. I mean, if you optimize iron stores downstream, you're going to be optimizing oxygen carrying capacity, which can optimize performance. But unlike anemic athletes, iron deficiency without anemia has not yet been shown definitively to improve performance, though the studies that have tried to show this have not been very large and certainly haven't solved the controversy surrounding the topic. And then there's the question of, you know, replacement is not harmless. Like the presentation yesterday, every treatment has its harm, whether it's cost or the the annoyance at taking the medication or the side effects like upset stomach or constipation with taking oral iron, or the potentially life-threatening situations of anaphylactoid reaction with parenteral iron administration. All of this harm for a benefit that we don't know if it exists or not. And finally, you can't blame them too much for doing this because seconds matter. And I challenge anyone to find enough athletes to do a study where you can find a statistically significant difference in a second or two of a 10-minute or a 20-minute or a 60-minute or 120-minute race. We just don't have the size of studies to show that a couple of seconds, which means the world to these athletes, is truly statistically significant. And then there's still a lot of unanswered questions about measuring ferritin and replacing iron itself. Like, at what level of ferritin should we be replacing iron? And how aggressively should we replace iron, if at all? And even though maybe iron replacement doesn't improve performance, maybe it at least prevents a decrease in performance, but we certainly don't know that. And something that I think is very interesting that I'm going to talk about a little bit more on the next slide is, do our measurements even accurately reflect these athletes' iron stores? Well, let's talk about ferritin in an athlete. There's in the two abnormalities that we would see with ferritin, high or low. Whether you're a runner or not, or me, if you have low ferritin, there's one reason why you have low ferritin. That's because you don't have enough iron. That does not mean you're anemic, though. It means that you simply don't have a lot of iron stores in your body. So why would an athlete or an endurance athlete become iron deficient? Well, if they're consuming a diet that's deficient in iron, such as you might see with a female athlete triad or an eating disorder, or with a typical college diet of Hot Pockets, which I survived on in college and medical school and last week. Menses in a female, that depletes iron. What about foot strike hemolysis? That's at least a destructive hemolysis, a traumatic hemolysis that depletes iron from a runner. What about GI losses? You know, there are several studies that show that more than half of runners experience some GI ischemia during particularly difficult runs. So that brings up the other question. What about high ferritin? If you remember, high ferritin, well ferritin is an acute phase reactant. So it increases in the face of inflammation independent of the true iron stores of the body. So if a runner is running hard enough to produce GI ischemia, are they also causing enough of an inflammation to falsely elevate or maybe falsely normalize their serum ferritin? And that's what we're looking at when we're monitoring them. And this is the question that I kind of wanted to get at with my, albeit small, study with the Weber State cross-country team. And even though my hopes and dreams for the study were a lot grander than it ended up being because of funding and compliance and things, this is the data that I was able to get. Firstly, we took all of the cross-country team from Weber State, males and females, measured their CBC and ferritin before the season. And then after the season, we were able to get 12 females to return and check their CBC and ferritin once again. Per the Weber State protocol, they were still supplemented with oral iron if their ferritin was less than 30. And a further workup was done in cases of anemia. And then it was simply doing the statistics with this. So here's our data from the preseason. 11 males, 26 females. As you can see, the average male ferritin preseason was higher than the average female ferritin level, but not to a significant degree. But in our small study, it did approach significance in how many females required iron supplementation compared to males based on the Weber State protocol of a ferritin level of 30. And I want you to, and just as a side note, none of the athletes that we checked here were anemic. But I want you to pay attention to that 12 number in the females who had a ferritin less than 30, because it is not the same as this number 12. This number 12 is the number of females who got both preseason and postseason measurements compared to the females who just got a preseason ferritin measurement. And in fact, that population of 12 that we got both pre- and postseason measurements on 11 of those 12 were females who had a ferritin less than 30 on the initial measurement, and thus were on iron supplementation for the duration of the season. One of those females who returned for a postseason test was not on iron supplementation because her ferritin was above 30. As you can see, there is a difference between the preseason and postseason ferritin by about 10 points. This was not significant either. But there was an increase. And the caveat I will say with that, and the reason why I find that one athlete who came back so interesting, was because all 11 athletes who did have iron supplementation throughout the season had an increase of their serum ferritin by a little bit more than 10. If you take that one female out who did not require iron supplementation throughout the season, her ferritin actually went down by about 10 points from the mid to high 30s to the mid 20s. So an interesting case study, even if I can't make a population hypothesis about it. And finally, to say that I had something statistically significant in my study, there was a statistically significant difference between the preseason mean of the females who came back for a study versus the preseason ferritin of the females who didn't come back for a study. So I guess they cared more. So there's obviously some limitations to this study. We had a small number of individuals participate, so it's hard to draw definitive conclusions with such an underpowered study. Also, almost all of the repeat ferritin measurements were in those who would have been iron supplemented, so it confounded our data a little bit. You know, was the increase in ferritin because of the iron supplementation, or was it from the course of the season itself? And finally, we can only make extrapolations about female athletes because they're the only ones who return for that second measurement. But I think we can draw at least a few conclusions from this. First, there was no difference between the preseason male and female ferritin levels, but there was a difference, at least it trended towards significance in a small study, of how many females required iron supplementation versus how many males required iron supplementation, at least according to the protocol used at Weber State. And the postseason ferritin levels did increase over the course of the season in the females who supplemented with iron, even to a non-significant degree, but it did increase in the face of the one female who didn't supplement herself and had a decrease in her serum iron or serum ferritin over the course of the season. Which brings me, you know, with these conclusions that I was hoping to be able to make and the conclusions that I was actually able to make, brings me to kind of what do we still need to do to figure this stuff out? Well, my hope for doing this study in the first place is this, and I wish I could do it again and have the funding and everything to do this, but instead of just a pre and a post season, get a pre and post exercise measurement of ferritin on these individuals several times throughout the season so that you can still get data for an entire season, but also know if exercise itself is affecting the ferritin measurements that we're getting. Another thing you could do is do that study while measuring how many miles they run to see if that has any effect on their ferritin or iron stores. If you're going to finally figure out whether supplementing iron actually increases performance, what you're going to have to do is get the population of iron-deficient, non-anemic runners, divide them into two halves, and do a randomized control trial of iron versus placebo. But good luck convincing a track coach to letting his athletes take a placebo over the course of a season. And one more thing that I think would be very interesting that I don't think has been studied at all that I found in the literature is this idea of zinc protoporphyrin levels. Zinc protoporphyrin, you may or may not know about. I didn't know about it before this, and I think only Dr. Vonk may know what this is. But zinc protoporphyrin it's actually an old way of screening for iron deficiency anemia that was done a lot in third world countries because it's cheap and easy. You draw blood, you put it in a spectroscopy machine, and there's your answer. But zinc protoporphyrin is placed into the hemoglobin molecule the second iron is gone. So zinc protoporphyrin increases before ferritin decreases and before anemia really starts. And it's not an acute phase reactant. So it wouldn't be confounded with these other factors that ferritin would be in these runners if ferritin really is a meaningful measurement in runners. So what? Well, I hope with today's presentation I was able to reach those objectives that I talked about earlier. Firstly, that I hope I was able to show you that ferritin levels do tend to increase in females, at least in our study, over the course of a season. Whether it was the running itself or the iron supplementation, we don't know. But for that very reason, we need to do more studies. We just don't know how important measuring ferritin is in endurance athletes. And yet we're exposing these athletes to the risk, however big or small, of supplementing with iron. And if we want to know whether we're doing them a net harm or a net benefit, then we need to do more studies to figure this out. Thank you very much.
All right, so as my presentation gets uploaded here, again, my name is Greg, and I'm heading back to Red Lodge, Montana, in a couple of months to get started on our practice up there. Oh, that's Bryce's presentation. So, I don't have any good jokes. Maybe Brian Campbell does. They're all bad jokes. Okay, so today we're going to talk about ethnicity and pain medications. And postpartum is in parentheses because that's the population that I specifically was interested in, we studied. So we'll talk about the study initially, and then we'll talk about some of the data later on. And first things first, I was told that you guys would all want to see a family picture, so learn a little bit about me. So there's my wife, Kelly, there's my young daughter, Savannah, and there's me. And we all have this sort of unhealthy obsession with the state of Montana, as you can tell by our t-shirts. And yeah, that's where we're headed, back home. So, conflict of interest, I have none. Why was I interested in this topic? So all of the residents do our prenatal clinic at Midtown Community Health Center, which is in downtown Ogden. And we serve a very large population of Hispanics. Probably a conservative estimate is that in our prenatal clinic, between 60 and 70% are Hispanic. Just a guess. And what I noticed is that when I was rounding on these patients after they had delivered, it seemed like there was a tendency for my Hispanic population to use less pain medications than my white population. Very controversial getting into race here, I know. But I asked around and I asked some of the other residents and they thought, yeah, I think I noticed that as well. And I even asked some of the other family medicine doctors who do deliveries from Midtown and some of the other obstetricians, and they agreed that, yeah, there might be a trend there. So I thought this would be an interesting thing to look at. And unfortunately, ethnicity and pain are both things that are hard to define definitively or hard to quantify reliably. So what I want to do now is tell you a little bit about some of the literature that I read. There's not a lot about this specific population, the postpartum population, as far as differences in ethnicity and how much pain medications they use. But there is a fairly robust body of literature about differences between different ethnicities in a wide variety of other settings, including the ED, chronic pain, hospice, and both inpatient and outpatient. I just want to share a couple of those with you. There's been several ER studies examining patients with long bone fractures. So we can all sort of agree that this is probably a reasonable indication for an opioid pain medication, if there ever was one. A couple of studies have found that Hispanics and blacks are significantly less likely to receive any pain medication in the ER with a long bone fracture. Another study evaluated Hispanic veterans with osteoarthritis compared to white veterans, and they found that they received about a two-week shorter supply of NSAIDs compared to their white counterparts. Also in the ER and postoperative settings, NSAIDs rather than opioids or opioids at a lower dose tended to be prescribed to minorities. So again, I'm not making a value or judgment statement on this, if this is good or bad, but this is just something that's been observed in these studies. Even in pediatric patients, pediatric abdominal pain in the ER, non-Hispanic black patients were significantly more likely to not receive any pain medication, any analgesic, during their stay in the ER. So there's a few studies that have found there's no difference in ethnicity, but these are far outweighed by the studies that found that there is actually a difference in how pain is treated. And I think even that statement you can get into trouble with, because is it that we're under-treating these patients of minority, or is it something that maybe the minority patients don't want these medications as much? And so we'll touch on that after we talk about our study. So my hypothesis, as I mentioned earlier, is that Hispanic patients in the postpartum period tend to use or receive, depending on how you look at it, less opioid pain medications than white patients. And we did also gather data on ibuprofen as well, but there's not a small number of providers who write that as scheduled in the postpartum period, so we decided not to look at that, that it might be a little bit less reliable. So we did a retrospective chart review from January 1st to that fateful day we introduced iCentra, October 24th. And we gathered data on demographics, average pain score throughout the hospitalization, and then a pain score 24 hours after delivery. We also looked at opioid medications that were both ordered and billed, and we converted this to milligram morphine equivalents for the sake of comparison. We did have some important exclusions. There was a few Medicare patients, a few patients on methadone, a few patients who had a length of stay greater than 6 days, and then we also only included medications that were ordered and billed on the postpartum floor. And the reason is, if any patient met these criteria, we felt that there would be some sort of extenuating circumstance that might make their situation unique. You know, there's not a lot of Medicare patients delivering babies, and so they're probably on dialysis or have something else going on that might confound the results. Similar with methadone. So let's look at the data. We found that our average age was about 28. Average length of stay was about 2 days. And this is both for vaginal and cesarean deliveries. Pain scores 24 hours after delivery were about 2. Average pain score throughout the course of the hospitalization was 2. And you notice that we're using median, and here's why. When we get to the total milligram morphine equivalents throughout the hospital stay, the median was 10. And you look at the range, and it goes all the way up to 1,400. And so we decided that the mean would not be a reliable representative of the average because it was skewed by these outliers, and so we used the median. We also calculated the milligram morphine equivalents used per day, and the average was about 6 milligrams across all comers besides the exclusion criteria we mentioned earlier. So for ethnicity, pretty decent-sized population of Hispanic females, just under 20%, and then non-Hispanic and by and large white. We didn't look at other ethnicities, but by and large that 81.5% is primarily white. Delivery type, we inadvertently got our cesarean section rate in this study, which was about 22%, which is pretty good compared to national averages. And vaginal deliveries, we did about 78%. So let's look at our average pain scores. For the Hispanic population, this was interesting. It actually was 2.2 about, non-Hispanics about 2.1, so not a big difference, and it wasn't statistically significant. But you can see, by and large, most patients have very low pain scores after they deliver. And then how many milligrams of morphine were administered in the postpartum period? You can see this first column is 0. So more than half of the patients required no opioids after they delivered at all. And as we increase the total milligrams of morphine in the postpartum period, the number of patients that required higher and higher doses tended to decrease. Just for an interesting comparison, I thought we'd also look at this. Does the amount of the average milligrams of morphine that a patient receives per day, does that correlate with their pain score? Because you would think that it should, right? Well, it doesn't very well, interestingly. The correlation coefficient was so kindly calculated by Dr. Clark Madsen, and it is 0.6. And I'm not going to lie, he sent this to me last night, so he's a really good guy. But the correlation here isn't as strong as I expected. So let's get to the meat of our study. Was there a difference in the amount of opioids used or received by Hispanics compared to non-Hispanics. And we use the measure average milligram morphine equivalents per day. You can see here that the Hispanic population did tend to use slightly lower amounts of opioids on average, but it was not a statistically significant difference. So we thought, let's dig a little bit deeper. And we were able to do a linear regression, by we I mean Clark, and control for age, ethnicity, marital status, insurance, delivery type. And only two variables were significant when we accounted for these other factors: the type of delivery, which probably shouldn't be surprising, and ethnicity became significant. Now, you'll notice the magnitude of the difference is not large, about 2.7 milligrams of morphine per day was used by Hispanics compared to whites. And if we multiply that out across the course of their hospital stay, 2 days, it's about one Norco. So there's about a difference of about one Norco. And it is statistically significant. However, this model was not a great fit. So we can't really use this to predict. Our R squared value, which Dr. Madsen can explain to you later, it was only 0.42, which is not as great as you would hope to be able to draw predictive conclusions from this. So what were some limitations? Well, it was retrospective. It was a chart review. We all know those aren't the greatest types of studies. Again, some medications written as PRN might not have been administered as PRN. You know, there's certainly variation within the nursing staff. My wife is a nurse, so I can say that. And we weren't able to include parity, which I thought would have been a really interesting variable to evaluate as well. So our study does show that maybe there is a little bit of a difference between Hispanic patients and white patients in how much pain medications they use. And this is consistent with the large body of data, the surprisingly large body of data out there. So the question that is more interesting to me is why? Why do we see this difference? And that's really a million-dollar question. You know, pain is so complex. Ethnicity is complex. So I just want to touch on a few of these important variables that might be contributing to this difference that we see. So pain sensitivity, kind of a biological perspective. Pain assessment, more of the interpersonal relationship. Physician factors, patient factors, cultural factors, and societal factors. So we'll try to buzz through these quick so I give Bryce enough time to give his talk. So there's been a few studies looking at pain sensitivity, comparing minorities to non-minorities, and this is in the lab setting. So they kind of tell you, stick your hand in this ice-cold bath of water and see how long you can leave your hand in there, which sounds horrible. But what they found is, in general, minorities tend to have a higher pain sensitivity than non-minorities, at least in America. Now, I think that this conclusion is a little bit misleading because there's a lot of confounders that weren't controlled for in these studies, a lot of social and cultural variables. And I'll touch on one right now, acculturation. There was a really interesting study that I read that compared first-generation Asian Americans to second-generation Asian Americans to white Americans. And they wanted to see if there was a difference in pain sensitivity. And they found that first-generation Asian Americans tended to be a little bit more sensitive to pain compared to white Americans. But they found that difference disappeared when you evaluated the second generation Asian Americans compared to white Americans. So there's this thought that maybe acculturation is such a stressful process that could influence that. Pain assessment. Are these scales that we use, are these even reliable amongst various ethnicities? And this has actually been studied extensively, and they found that these face scales and these number scales are pretty reliable in measures of pain across different ethnicities. However, and this is important and not really surprising, minority patients tend to be less likely than whites to be adequately assessed for pain, which, if you think about it, in our population, you know, the postpartum, there's a nurse that has maybe 5 patients, and maybe she only speaks English, and one of her patients is Spanish-speaking only. It's not surprising to me that patient's pain is not going to be assessed as accurately as the white patient's. And I don't think it's by virtue of that nurse trying to not do as good a job. It's just there's a lot of stresses on that nurse to keep up with all that they have to do. What about physician factors? What role do we play in this? So there's been a few studies that show that physicians in general tend to underestimate patient pain compared to what the patients rate their own pain, which I'm not really surprised about. However, we tend to underestimate the pain of minority patients disproportionately more compared to white patients. And they found that this is, interestingly, even more robust for residents compared to attending physicians. So, sorry guys. There may all be also be an interplay of some stereotypes. Now, I don't think I have stereotypes. We all don't think we use stereotypes. But there is some papers out there that say there may be some subconscious stereotypes that we, although we have good intentions of treating everyone equal, these may actually have an effect on our behavior. Whether you believe that or not, I'll leave that up to you. Lack of cultural awareness is another important one. They've done some studies and they found that providers who speak Spanish tend to do a better job of assessing pain for Spanish-speaking patients. Again, not surprising. And they tend to have, those patients have a higher satisfaction for how their pain is treated. And there may be some, again, this might go back to the stereotypes I mentioned earlier, there may be a higher concern about substance abuse and diversion in minority patients from the providers. How about patient factors? Pain intensity underreporting. Well documented that particularly Hispanics tend to underreport pain relative to white Americans. And whether this is due to sort of a value placed on stoicism, I can't really say, but it's, again, it's something that has been documented, but we don't necessarily have to attach a value judgment to it. What about concern about taking too much analgesic medications? This is a big one, and a lot of studies found that Hispanic patients tend to be far more concerned than whites about taking too much pain medication, for taking pain medication for the wrong indications, or for taking pain medication for lower levels of pain. Similarly, there seems to be a higher fear of addiction or medication side effects among minorities, and again, particularly Hispanics compared to whites. So what about cultural factors? I just want to read this statement to you because I think it sums it up well. Culturally specific attitudes and beliefs about the origin, role, and meaning of pain influence the manner in which individuals view and respond to their own pain, as well as how they perceive and respond to the pain of others. And of course, this goes both ways, both the patient and the provider. I'll skip through these couple slides just for the sake of time, or the coping slide. So societal factors, poverty, lack of insurance, lack of primary care. We all know that minorities tend to be disproportionately affected by some of these factors. And then interestingly, pharmacies that tend to be utilized by minority patients tend to not stock opioids as much as other pharmacies, which is really interesting to me. And why is that? There's some thought that it's due to, well, of course, they're worried about being robbed, but there's also thought that maybe these pharmacies perceive that there's a lower demand for opoids. They're more concerned about disposal, insurance reimbursement, paperwork, fear of getting a DEA audit, etc. So again, this is a big topic, and someone could spend their whole PhD dissertation examining just one small aspect of this. But in summary, pain is very complex, and there's this sort of multifaceted approach towards pain that we should take. And as providers, I think it's important for us to do a little bit of self-reflection and self-awareness and think about making sure that we equitably treat all these patients. And again, that doesn't mean necessarily giving more opioids. We've had plenty of talks during this conference that say that probably isn't a good idea. And then I think cultural awareness is another important thing for us. Think about the context of your patient, what their life may be like, and also the context of their presentation. So acute pain versus chronic pain. If there's a Hispanic, you know, a patient who may be more likely to underreport their pain and they have a femur fracture, it might be okay to say, this is an okay time to use opioids. And conversely, if you encounter a patient who might be a little bit less likely to request opioids in the outpatient setting for something like chronic pain, great, right? That's a great thing. Maybe we reward that or we encourage that. So that's all I got for you today. I just want to acknowledge Clark. Marion Gorder's the data analyst at McKay, and she gathered all of our data. Tim Drake's the pharmacist who gave me the opioid conversion tables, and Mark Meldrum is the librarian at McKay who helped me with my literature review. So thanks, I'll turn it over to Bryce.
That is the correct one, thanks. Well, I want to start off and tell you a little bit about our residency, and I'm sure it's like many of the residencies that you trained at, but as I've been going through my training for the first, well, for the 3 years of residency, just like you, even in your clinics now, you're seeing many, many patients with diabetes, type 2 diabetes, and that number continues to grow. With ourselves at Porter Clinic, we have the opportunity to take care of a population that's underserved, many times does not have insurance. And so that brings up a lot of difficulties as far as abilities to treat and get the appropriate medications that they'll be able to afford in order to help them with their with diabetes and the effects that come with diabetes. So as I was thinking about the talk here at Ogden Surgical for the last 3 years, I was trying to figure out something pertinent to everyone. And I challenge any specialist or anyone in this room who says that they don't deal with diabetes in one level or another. And we all do. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the novel medications that we have had come out over the last few years and their benefits on A1C and whether or when we should be prescribing these medications. So just like the other residents, I don't have any disclosures, but I wanted to start off by reviewing a little bit of the information concerning just diabetes in America today. So we know it's the leading cause of kidney failure, non-traumatic lower limb amputation, and new cases of blindness among adults in the U.S. 9.3% of the U.S. population has diabetes. 1 in 10 people, and that number continues to grow, has diabetes. Major causes, as we know, of heart disease and stroke, and it's the 7th leading cause of death in the United States. Looking at the age distribution with the prevalence of diabetes, we see that the majority of patients are 45 years and older, and then even more so at the age of 65 and up. A lot of this is due to the good old American diet, the American lifestyle, and as we talked about a little bit yesterday, some of the foods that we intake and the caloric amounts that they have. So what are the costs? They did a study in 2012, the American Diabetes Association, and they analyzed the total costs associated with diabetic care, and they estimated it to be about $176 billion in direct medical costs. So that's your office visits, that's your emergency care, that's your ambulance, that's hospital care, all of that combined, $176 billion. In addition to that, there's about $70 billion in basically indirect medical costs of not able to go to work, decreased productivity. The important thing that I think about that, besides that being a massive number, is 42% increase over a 5-year period. And I ask that myself, why is there such an increase, almost a 50% increase in the cost of diabetic care over 5 years? And the studies show that it's due to increased incidence of diabetes. About 12% of the total healthcare cost towards diabetes is due to medications. So the study that I'm involved in and that I had done, and it's an observational study, deals with 12% of the finances towards diabetic care. So this is for both type 1 and type 2 diabetes patients, but we can kind of see the breakdown of which patients get what. About 14% of patients, whether they know they have diabetes or don't know that they have diabetes, are receiving no medical medications at this time. There's 14% in the other categories of both insulin and oral medications, and then insulin alone by itself. But the large majority of patients are receiving oral medications. I want you to think about your clinic and your practice and think, how many oral medications are they on? Is it 1? Is it 2? Is it 3? How many medications, and in addition to insulin, are they on? So what do the guidelines say? I'm going to talk about a little bit of the recommendations at the beginning and then also at the end to summarize. This is from the American Diabetes Association, and this was updated in 2016. And their level A of evidence recommendation is that we start metformin as a first-line therapy. Why is that? We know that, if anything, it causes a little bit of weight loss or no weight gain. We know that it decreases A1C, which decreases microvascular pathology. And there are studies that show that, importantly, there's a change in morbidity and mortality with cardiovascular events with metformin. What about the other medications? We'll talk about that. The ADA also recommends that if non-insulin monotherapy is at maximum tolerated dose over a course of 3 months, that we should either add a second agent, start insulin, or a GLP agonist. So we have the options to choose between those things. But they do emphasize with grade B level of evidence to not delay initiation and starting of insulin for our therapies. So what was my study? So at Intermountain, we have the entire urban north region. So that includes more than these counties, but it includes Davis County, of course, Weber County, Morgan, and Cache County, along with a few others. And the study that I wanted to do is per ADA recommendations, every patient should be started on metformin as our initial therapy. So the criteria was patients who were started on a second agent after April of 2014, but had previously only been prescribed metformin. They all had to have the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. With that query and with the ability to find a one-year A1C result, we had just over 1,000 patients, 1,063 patients. So I just wanted to go over some of the medications that I'm emphasizing right now to just discuss a little bit of their mechanism of action. So we're going to look at the GLP agonists, which are an injection. There's various types. But their main modality is increasing glucose-dependent insulin secretion, but also decreasing the amount of glucagon secretion. The benefit of that is it increases satiety and also, as we'll see, can cause slow and gastric emptying and potentially some weight loss. Next, we have the SGLT2 inhibitors, which work at the proximal nephron by affecting the sodium glucose transporter. Basically, it causes decreased absorption of glucose, causing increased glucosuria and decreasing your blood sugar. Okay? Sulfonylureas are well known. We've had them for years and years, and they're basically a pancreatic pump. They're going to cause increased insulin production. I did not study all of them, so we're just going to focus on a few of them. And then we've got the DPP-4 inhibitors, which inadvertently work pretty similar to the GLP agonist by increasing insulin production and decreasing glucagon production. So looking at our study results, we see that we have a pretty even distribution between males and females. The age distribution is pretty similar to the stats that we saw by the ADA. There's a great majority of patients, 60 and older, that have a pretty high prevalence of diabetes among that population. I just wanted to start off by the limitations so that you kind of see what the data show and maybe why some of the data is the way that it is. The query that we did only involved the medications of metformin being the initial treatment and then starting a second line medication. It did not take into account the massive polypharmacy that can be seen, so antipsychotic medications. It didn't involve any of that if they were on statin medications, like blood pressure modifying medications. Also, we were not able to check compliance. We weren't able to check refill rates. We were only able to see these prescriptions sent by the physician to change their therapy. And then finally, we weren't able to evaluate their lifestyle modifications. We hope that every provider is emphasizing these modifications, but we don't know which patients are actually able to make those changes. So what did we see? So looking at the A1's average A1C, this is before we started the second therapy. So they're all on metformin at this time. The average A1C varies, but is pretty close to the range of 8 among most of our populations. The line is the median, and then the diamond there, it looks like a circle, is the average. So breaking this down, what percentage of the population that I'm looking at actually received what for second medication? By far, the majority were prescribed sulfonylureas as their second line of medicine. The next groups, GLP-1s, DPP-4s, were a little bit above the SGLT2 inhibitors. So what did we see? So I apologize that the graphs are a little bit small there, but we see that the A1C changes. That the large proportion, initially, the A1C at start date was 7.0 to 8.0, with about 25 or 22% on both groups. As we look, this is a one-year follow-up. We do see a leftward shift in the A1C, so we see improvement, but this is all of the different groups combined. When we look at the separate groups themselves, again, the diamond is the average and the line is the median. The greatest change that we see are the SGLT2 inhibitors, almost an A1C change of 1. The other medications, granted there is quite a bit of variance with them, have a drop in A1C from anywhere from 0.3 to 0.7. Okay. These lines here are variance and with the standard deviation, and unfortunately or fortunately, there is no statistical significance between any of the groups, even though the SGLT2s had a larger A1C here. There is no significant change between the groups. So I wanted to compare that data to some of our national data, and this was a meta-analysis of 24 randomized controlled trials, which compared average A1C drop as well as weight changes. As you can see, the GLPs, DPP-4s, and sulfonylureas had very similar A1C drops, anywhere from 0.8 to almost 1%. There was a difference in weight gain versus weight loss. As you can see, GLP had about 2 kilo, whereas the sulfonylureas had a 2 kilo weight gain. A separate study showed that SGLT2s had pretty similar, but about a 1% drop from the studies, and they also had a weight gain. In that study, it also showed that there was a mild decrease in blood pressure, but there is an increased side effect rate of fungal infections and urinary tract infections, about 10 to 13% in women and 4% in men for the SGLT2s. The thing that I wanted to point out and to discuss is I looked up the average cost of these medications on GoodRx.com. So take it with a grain of salt. Every pharmacy is going to be a little different. $4 for a month's supply versus $370 versus $576. Now, take that into account, and we do need to put the patient first, but I want you to think, is this the only medicine that they're on? I can almost guarantee you that they're not. Hopefully a lot of the other medicines are a little bit cheaper as well. But it should come into play in our decision-making as far as these medications go. So what does the ADA and then the ACE group recommendations recommend? So the ADA recommends that they don't recommend anything other for their second-line therapy. They give you the option to choose of your second-line therapy, whether that be a sulfonylurea, a DPP-4. And this chart, I think, is very helpful. You can find it on the ADA website. But it talks about the high-risk events with them and then the associated side effects. Well, sulfonylureas, they do point out the fact that there is an increase in weight gain and also there's an increased risk of hypoglycemia. These newer novel agents do not have the risk of the hypoglycemia, which is significantly important. Looking at the ACE recommendations, this is American Academy of Clinical Endocrinologists. They, from my personal opinion, they're definitely more aggressive as far as their treatment of care. The ADA recommends an average A1C of 7.0 with those patients who don't have, you know, less than a 10-year risk, mortality risk, those who aren't at risk of dying sooner or who have had diabetes longer than 10 years. For the ACE recommendations, they recommend an average A1C of 6.5 or lower. Why do they recommend that? Because we know A1C is not necessarily related to mortality, but it does correlate to microvascular complications. So your nephropathy, your neuropathy, and your diabetic retinopathy are directly correlated to your A1C. The lower the A1C, the decreased risk. So their recommendations are, I'm just going to focus on that first bar to the left, is their monotherapy. They actually don't state that metformin has to be the first line therapy. The order from top to bottom is their recommendations as far as best benefit. But you could also theoretically start a GLP, you could do a DPP-4. And then the green versus yellow is the level of evidence of risk associated with them. Of course, TZDs and sulfonylureas have the hypoglycemic effects. So why is this important? I just want to read a few quotes about the ADA and then leave it up to you to decide. It says, unfortunately, the paucity of high-quality evidence in the form of well-controlled clinical trials that directly compare different diabetes treatment regimens remains a major impediment to recommending one class of drugs or a particular combination of therapies over another. Cost can be an important consideration in drug selection. As the prices of newer medications continue to increase, practitioners should take into account patient and societal resources and determine when less costly generic products might be appropriately used. And finally, we previously described the need to individualize both treatment targets and treatment strategies with an emphasis on patient-centered care and shared decision-making, and this continues to be our position, which I agree with. In summary, I think we really need to look at our patients and decide on what medication is best for them. We do have the fiduciary responsibility of deciding about costs and benefits to the patient, but there are plenty of patients that I've seen in clinic that continue to benefit from sulfonylurea care and are able to take it without the risk of hypoglycemia. I think we definitely need to work on education, but it's a good opportunity for us to know of all these medications, have many tools in our bag, and decide, do we really want to add a second, third medicine, or do we need to go to insulin since they're already on maybe 5, 6, 7 other medicines to prevent their hyperlipidemia, hypertension, cardiovascular risk factors, along with other things. And that's my conclusion. Thank you.
We'll now entertain questions for these three panelists, if there are any.
Oh, boy.
Okay, there's Dr. Gardner. Go to the microphone.
No, don't.
So this question is for Dr. Martindale. So you talked about ferritin as well as the role within anemia and iron deficiency. As we know that iron and ferritin also has, well, iron in general has more than just a role in anemia. Within the body, it also is contained in other enzymes that are iron dependent, such as the cytochromes, ribonuclease reductase, iron sulfur proteins that are their job is to work with, you know, energy production, xenobiotic metabolism, you know, cellular reproduction, other issues in the body. Can you comment on how low iron stores can affect other areas of the body besides just anemia?
I can't.
And how that would affect athletic performance?
The primary concern with the athletes is strictly on kind of the idea of anemia and preventing anemia. I don't think any studies that I came across kind of addressed the other roles of ferritin, at least in relationship to other processes in the body that could potentially affect endurance or performance. So besides the fact that I don't understand some of the words you said, some of those things just haven't come up in the sense of a running or an endurance athlete as far as what effects those might have on their performance. But certainly, the studies that have been done that directly relate to anemia or iron deficiency, they're just as small as mine, and they make about as strong conclusions as my study did. And so to even take it beyond that is something that, I mean, we haven't even done the first part yet. So.
Other questions? Yes, ma'am. While she's coming up to the microphone, I have a quick one for Bryce. So as you mentioned, increasing costs in diabetic care, what is your thought about just the increasing cost of medicines that have been around a long time, for instance, insulin?
Well, I think it's similar to every other physician's sentiment. It's colchicine, too. I mean, when you see a change in medication, you feel like the patient isn't the number one priority in the American healthcare system. It's money.
So there's a lot of greed, huh?
Frustrating.
Ma'am?
That was very much my question. I have a lot of diabetics who suddenly are telling me that now their plain Jane insulin is costing them $600 a month. And is it time to go back to plain Jane medicine? I mean insulin.
Well, I think it's in our clinic we use 70-30 quite often to try and help with costs. Eventually, there is a point that I argue that insulin is far better as far as control goes with A1C, but I think we're going to have to, it's interesting, but as residents, we're having to learn some of the older medications in addition to the newer medications to make sure we can continue to use those older regimens.
Yes, ma'am.
Good job, everyone. Is it Greg in the middle?
Yep.
Dr. Burfein, as I said. My question was, I don't know if you looked at this, but did you look at all at how many pills people received when they were discharged? Is that something that you have just noticed? I guess even anecdotally is my question, because I feel like, I'm not going to try to date myself, I'm not that old. But when I was in med school, it was like standard. Everyone got like, I think a fairly large amount of narcotics when they left. And I'm just wondering, and even like for me, like in academic hospitals, when I've delivered my own children, I feel like I'm given a pretty large prescription for narcotics. I've actually like turned it in and said, I don't really want this. But I'm wondering if you've noticed a difference and just maybe how that's being prescribed in the hospital.
So we did try to evaluate that, but during the time we did our analysis, there wasn't a lot of people using the e-prescribe tool, so we couldn't really track it very well. And I know there's a lot of obstetricians who just write like a standard like Norco prescription like before the patient has even gone to postpartum, so I didn't know that it would be that reliable. But from what I've seen, Yeah, I think there's a lot of prescriptions that are way overboard, especially when you look at like the average pain, right? I mean, average pain was like 2 to 4, so it's pretty low. And you see these people getting 30 Norcos to go home with. It seems a little bit absurd.
Dr. Gary?
Dealing with obesity and diabetes. This is an interesting phenomena that's come about. They found in these morbidly obese people with diabetes, bariatric surgery, of course, can be very effective in treating the obesity. The interesting thing that they found is, with the obesity gone, their diabetes also goes. And I saw an article here not too long ago that this might be one of these new treatments for the treatment of diabetes that's very resistant. I'd like a commentary.
Yeah, so some of the recommendations are interesting. Looking up the ACE recommendations, they recommend a BMI of 27 or more to consider starting weight loss medications such as phentermine, orlistat. A BMI of 35 or more is a recommendation to consider gastric bypass surgery. And my thought process behind this is, I mean, these medications clearly change weight. Some of the studies show that even though you change your weight loss by about 7%, you get an A1C drop. It can change microvascular changes, but there hasn't been, as far as I know, a cardiovascular change. And so my thought process is the time to change weight is pre-diabetes, is metabolic syndrome. By the time they've reached diabetes, you're looking at medications that are going to cause weight gain. Insulin is an anabolic steroid in and of itself, and it's going to cause weight gain. There's nothing that the patient can do dietary-wise in a way to prevent some of those effects. And so the best way, if we can, is to work on that weight loss and prevention. But if they're reaching the BMI of 35, I don't know if these oral medications are going to get that change that we're wanting to. It might have to be surgical intervention.
So last question for the first section will be the incredibly young and dynamic Dr. Roger Smith.
Thank you for that. I just have more of a comment than anything, maybe about the ferritin lecture. I think you mentioned this was your study was done with the athletes in the college level. I happened to have a patient of mine about a year ago that was, she actually was a Olympic level athlete. She was in the Olympic trials in marathoning and didn't make it through because of some injury. But when she got through with Olympic trials, she started running as an age grouper or as non-professional ability. And she came to me about 2 weeks before a marathon she'd been planning for months and asked me about her ferritin. We drew her ferritin and it was around 30, and I really didn't know what to do with that. And she said, well, that's low, and I've been taking iron all this time, and I want you to give me a blood transfusion. And I said, hey, no, I don't do that kind of stuff. That's probably not medically indicated, and it's probably illegal. And she said, well, I think I can go to another town nearby and get one of the college-level doctors to get me a blood transfusion. And I don't know did you run into any of that kind of talk? I know a lot of that's secretive, and, you know, it probably still goes on. You talk about Lance Armstrong and all that stuff, but any word about that in your research?
Yes. I told you pretty blatantly what we do at Weber State, and we chose that number 30. It's kind of arbitrary, because if you look at the literature just in what is considered low ferritin, not in an athlete, but just in the general population, the general thought is that if you say a ferritin lower than 15 is anemic, that's highly specific, but it's not very sensitive, because a lot of people who have a ferritin greater than 15 are also iron deficient, if you were to draw their bone marrow and do a stain and look at how much iron's there. Where you kind of hit the sweet spot of sensitivity and specificity is actually around 40. So to answer one part of your question is, we just don't know what number is important to replace iron, if at all, in these athletes. The answer to the second part, or another answer to that question, is at Weber State we've chosen 30 and we give them oral iron. There are other colleges in this state that give IV iron to everybody, regardless of what their ferritin is. And that's kind of the the thing is just we don't know whether this is right or not. And if you even want to get into the ethics of this, I mean, we all know that blood doping or autologous transfusion is pretty blatantly against the rules in most of these groups. But, I mean, is giving someone extra iron? I mean, that's kind of the purpose of the autologous transfusion is giving iron. Is that ethically right? I mean, those are all questions that haven't been answered yet. And I guess the safe way to go about it is... If they're iron deficient, replace it, and if not, then do exactly what you did. So that's kind of my opinion on it.
Thank you very much, and it's nice to know that Beaver is still a bastion of integrity.